Advertising your business with GCN is simple, effective,
and more affordable than you might think.
Visit advertise.gcnlive.com for more info. Take your business to the next level.
The gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
Before we get started here with our special guest, Paul Shatskin, who has written a book about scientists you probably didn't know about, a couple of books about that, I want to mention something that we talked about in a previous episode. And it'll show you how much I know about the field, Tim. And that is, I mentioned about the place I lived when I was really young, in Brooklyn, New York, at 102 Newport Street. And I suggested that now, since it's a brownstone that's probably been remodeled a dozen times, the rentals there for a two-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment would probably be around $3,000. And sure enough, when you look it up, Zillow, 2 years ago, listed it for $2,850, so it has to be $3,000 now. Do I know my real estate, Tim?
You do. You're in the wrong business.
Well, I wish I was in the right business here because I'd have something to show for it. Of course, it could also be a lucky guess. But to buy the property, it's worth over $800,000. This is a four-family brownstone.
And it's only $800,000? I would think it'd be in the millions.
It was built before World War II.
Still.
So it's, yeah. This is 102 Newport Street between Hopkinson and Amboy in Brooklyn, New York. It's a lot of organized crime originated there. I didn't know that when I was a kid. So anyway, Paul, you've written books about figures that maybe people know very little or nothing about. And of all the historical figures one might select, what led you to these two that we'll be talking about?
Well, I've written two books. I like to describe myself as a biographer of obscure 20th century scientists. And the two scientists that I seem to have devoted my adult life to, first was a man named Philo T. Farnsworth, and the other was a man named Thomas or T. Townsend Brown. And honestly, the journey for me started, in the summer of 1973, I first learned about Philo Farnsworth in an obscure publication for underground video producers in the 1970s, which is what I did when I was in college. And this issue of a magazine called Radical Software came out and informed me for the first time that television was an invention, and that it was invented by a 14-year-old farm boy from Idaho named Philo T. Farnsworth, whose name I had not heard prior to that. And when I saw this article and some of the imagery of television from the 1920s and 30s, it dawned on me that that was kind of filling in a gap in my knowledge of history that I didn't even know was there. We have no legend or lore around the emergence of what is arguably the most dominant communications medium in the history of human civilization. It's a great and compelling story, and it has been kept from us. It's been swept under the rug. But that's the story that I learned about in the summer of 73. I learned more about Farnsworth later on in that summer about the work that he did later in his life in the field of nuclear fusion. I think that's where the hook really got set. I met the Farnsworth family in 1975, worked with them closely over a period of time, and finally, just long story short, because we're just getting started, was able to publish the material that I had gathered and researched over the course of 20-odd years and published the book, The Boy Who Invented Television, in 2002, which was then republished last year, again under the same title. When I was finishing that book in 2002, due to some other changes in my life and circumstances, I think I have now embarked on a career, as I said a moment ago, as a biographer of obscure 20th century scientists, and I'm looking for what to do as my encore project when this first book comes out. And then literally, out of the blue, An email shows up in my inbox a night in July of 2002 telling me to look up this guy called T. Townsend Brown, whose name I had also never heard of before that. Long story short, the email said that Orthodox Science says that what he discovered is impossible. Nevertheless, the military classified it, and that what he discovered you can see in blue lights and blue hazy lights flying over the deserts of Nevada. It also shows up in an appliance called the Ionic Breeze Air Purifier that the Sharper Image sold on infomercials on TV in the, I guess, late 90s and aughts. So that was my introduction to the second story that I researched and wrote for about 6 years from 2003 to 2009. Couldn't make any sense of it. Walked away from it in 2009, and then again, due to a variety of circumstances, came back to it in 2022 and finished the book and published it in 2023, and that one is called The Man Who Mastered Gravity. So there's a thumbnail sketch of how we get here.
Now, we'll go through the thumbnails and try to bring out more information, but just a quick personal question that you do not have to answer. Other than writing books about people most people never heard of, you have a day job?
Not anymore.
Well, that's good.
You know, I'm in my 70s. I'm what they like to call retired now. Over the course of my life, I don't think the word career applies because I really did many different things over the course of what would have been my working life. I went to Hollywood in 1973 to seek my fortune in the TV industry. When that didn't pan out the way I wanted it to, I went to Hawaii and went sailing for 8 years and took tourist sailing, snorkeling, and whale watching. Then I came to Nashville in 1994, started an internet business, which I had a liquidity moment around, and that's when I became a biographer of obscure 20th century scientists.
Okay, so you did professions that nobody ever heard about.
I've been an outsider pretty much all my life.
Actually, it kind of sounds like fun. It really does. But let's go look at these particular figures. And before we get into Mr. Farnsworth and the TV and his invention, why is it that we don't hear about this guy? I would think someone like that, they talk about him in school.
You would think. And the capsule answer that I have to that question is that there are three reasons why we are not more familiar with the name Philo T. Farnsworth, who, as we begin to unpack his story, you'll see was truly a pivotal person in human evolution, based on what he did in the 1920s, and then maybe again in the 1960s. But the reason we're not more familiar with him in terms of his contribution to video, which is the most pervasive appliance in the history of appliances, and it can all be traced back to a sketch that he drew for his high school science teacher in 1922, but the reason we don't know of him are three. The first is he was not one who was inclined to dwell on his past achievements. He was very much a forward-looking kind of person, and particularly after he became less involved with television in the 1940s and 50s, his mind was going in entirely different directions, and the fact that he wasn't getting any recognition was really not much of a concern to him. So that's the first reason. The second reason is that there are pretenders to that throne. And so if you go into, I guess, Wikipedia nowadays, you'll find there are all kinds of names. Farnsworth has become one of them, but he deserves to be one of them in a much more paramount way than he is treated. And that's because of the third reason, which was he was not survived by his own company. And there are companies that survived who have basically controlled the narrative around that story.
History being the province of those who won, the victors.
And yes, that's the bromide, and it certainly seems to apply in this case. But one of the more interesting aspects of the story is that Farnsworth, he at least won a battle of major significance over the course of his career that has also been swept under by the decades of subsequent public relations. But the detail that I'm leaning toward here is that prior to 1939, his adversary, his nemesis through the 1930s, was the Radio Corporation of America and its chief executive, David Sarnoff. who I like to refer to as the Darth Vader of communications history.
Okay. Okay. We've got Paul and Tim and Gene. More about Mr. Vader. You're in
the Paracast.
Hey, listeners. I want you to have the entire Paracast experience. So I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
People often write to tell us what has happened for them since starting Extendivite. Allow me to read a few. After taking Extendivite for about 6 months, I've noticed improvement on the numbness of my hands and wrists from the carpal tunnel syndrome. I will continue to buy product. This formula is very powerful. I am feeling much better. My heart rate and blood pressure is stabilized. My lower edema has reduced, and lower leg pain due to blood clots has disappeared. This product has relieved what appears to be an angina problem, pain in the chest after climbing stairs and short on breath. I'm quite happy about it. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit extendivite.com. That's extendivite.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Bad theater seats, cheap Halloween masks, my apartment, all things with obstructed views. Add to these large trucks and buses. 18-wheelers and large buses have big blind spots and, like my apartment, they don't always have the best view. Bus and truck drivers deal with blind spots around the entire vehicle. Always take care not to ride alongside or too close behind them. Our roads, our responsibility. Learn more at sharetheroadsafely.gov.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a free copy of my lecture that tells you exactly how to do it. In fact, after you've lived a long and healthy life, there should be only two documents in your medical chart, a birth certificate and a death certificate. I'm Dr. Wallach with a warning. If you have a 4-inch medical chart, if you take prescription drugs for high cholesterol, high blood pressure, arthritis, joint pains, and other health issues, the medical profession is failing you. They're using you for an ATM machine. My free lecture is going to reveal what pharmaceutical companies don't want you to know. There's been groundbreaking research and discoveries on how to effectively treat or eliminate over 900 different diseases naturally. It's all in my free lecture called Deadly Recipe. So call toll-free 1-855-79-YOUNG. Again, that's toll-free 1-855-79-YOUNG. 1-855-79-YOUNG.
Do you know someone with a drug or alcohol problem? Get help now. Insurance may cover everything. Stop the drug and alcohol nightmare. Call 800-284-0523. Learn how through the Family Medical Leave Act, you can leave your job without losing your job. Locations everywhere. Get immediate help for drug and alcohol problems. Call now. 800-284-0523. 800-284-0523.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
Speaking of Darth Vader, I used to do that with my son Grayson. I'd look at him and say, "I am your father." Now, a lot of figures in industry are Darth Vaders to one degree or another, aren't they? How did this guy become the Darth Vader.
Yes, to the extent that big industries are empires in their own right, it's not an inapt or inept analogy. The story behind David Sarnoff is that he rose to prominence in the Radio Corporation of America during the 1920s and 30s. He started his career as a telegraph operator for the American Marconi Company, and after World War One, during World War One, the American Marconi Company was sort of subsumed by the United States government so that the military could have control of the Marconi radio patents. And then after World War One, those patents and some others were spun off into what became the Radio Corporation of America. So RCA was essentially a government-spawned monopoly that controlled most of the patents governing the art and science of radio. And because of the way the communications and electrical industries were structured going through the 1920s, there were essentially a trust agreements between these big companies like AT&T, General Electric, RCA, and Westinghouse that divided up the territory. And the Radio Corporation was essentially assigned everything in the way of patent structure that had to do with radio broadcasting. And their policy was that the Radio Corporation was formed to collect patent royalties, not to pay patent royalties. As the art and science of radio evolved through the 1920s, as new art emerged, RCA would find a way to either acquire that technology or put the inventors of this new technology out of business and then acquire the technology that way. So over the course of the 1920s, RCA had this huge patent portfolio for radio, and by then this man, David Sarnoff, had risen to the level of general manager of RCA, just rising through the corporate ranks. And one of the things that he did that made him notable to history and to the board of directors of RCA was he started the National Broadcasting Company, NBC. And here's where, one of the areas where you see these various monopolies at work, because part of the agreement was that AT&T would stay out of the radio business as long as RCA used AT&T's wires to transmit its network signals around the country to the stations in its network. So RCA stayed out of the wired communications business and AT&T stayed out of the radio communications business. Convenient, huh? So as we get into the mid to late 1920s, it becomes apparent that the patents for radio are going to run their course. A patent has an 18-year life extended by however long it's litigated, or 17-year life, I'm sorry. And some of the fundamental patents that had made radio possible were beginning to reach the end of their life expectancy. So now any good corporate executive or emperor is going to look around to see what territory will be next to be conquered. And by then, television was very much on the tip of people's tongues, but really nobody knew how to do it until Philo T. Farnsworth showed up in 1927. And the long story short there is that Sarnoff was determined to continue RCA's policy of collecting patent royalties and not paying them into the new realm of television, and did everything it could to contest all of Farnsworth's patents, to saddle him with enormous legal costs to defend his patents, and spent millions of dollars, multi-millions, tens of millions of dollars, compared to Farnsworth's expense over the course of a decade of maybe one, to engineer his way around Farnsworth's patents. So he had other engineers and inventors developing things, and at every turn they kept running into Farnsworth's patents. And finally, in 1939, RCA, for the first time in its corporate history, was compelled to accept a license from Farnsworth for the use of his patents and paid him $1 million. For the first time in its corporate history that it ever paid anybody for a patent.
Now, just in parenthetically, RCA sounds like the first Microsoft.
Well, all of them are. RCA, General Electric, AT&T, Westinghouse, sure. Yeah, that's Microsoft and its ilk Google, Apple, the FANG companies, they are all a continuation of a long trend over the course of mostly the 20th century of consolidating corporate assets and controlling monopolistic markets.
Well, Disney's doing a little bit of that now, buying up other properties. They bought up 20th Century Fox Films.
Yeah.
There is a merger that's brewing now between Paramount Plus, which includes CBS, by the way.
Uh-huh.
And that means it also includes Star Trek. So there you go with that. Maybe a merger involving Max, which includes DC Comics. So this is in every industry. But let's look at the history of Mr. Farnsworth. So
sure.
He's 14, yeah. And he comes up with this concept of what becomes a TV. Let's get into the details.
Okay. So the idea of television, what we now call television, it had a lot of different names until television settled. And I recall one person saying that the word television is half Greek and half Latin. No good can ever come from it. But that was the term that they finally landed on around the mid-1920s. But the idea is a kind of a marriage of technologies that preceded it. By the time you get into the 1920s, we already have motion pictures, and we have radio, and we have radio sound recording, and other means by which audio and visual technologies are being distributed. The expectation was that at some point, motion pictures and radio be merged, and we'd have moving pictures that fly through the air. And the experiments to achieve that began as early as the 1880s, but they used a mechanical approach. And the heart of the earliest attempts at television were built around a spinning disc that has a kind of spiral of perforations in it. And the reason for the perforations is because the challenge of transmitting a video image is that you have to break it down into its component parts of light and dark elements, convert those into an electrical signal, and then transmit that electrical signal by wire or by air. So the earliest attempts to achieve that trick of breaking the optical image down into its component light and dark parts was done with these mechanical devices. So you've literally got an electric motor spinning a disc in front of an image, and then the light from that image being reflected through the holes in the disc and hitting a photocell to create a pulsing electrical stream.
Well, we're talking with Paul Shatskin about the invention of TV by someone most of you never heard of, with Gene and Paul and Tim. You're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
If you're concerned about the power grid and want to generate your own supply of off-grid electricity, this will be the most important message you'll hear this year. Here's why. We now have a small number of solar generators back in stock. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving backup power when you need it most. And unlike gas generators, solar generators run quietly, emit no dangerous fumes, and produce an endless supply of free electricity from the sun. Whether it's wildfires, dangerous weather, power grid issues, or just getting off the grid, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. Even better, all this week, radio listeners get over $700 in free off-the-grid bonuses, too. Go to MySolarBackup.com to learn more and check availability. That's MySolarBackup.com. Look for the free report, Crisis Cooling, how to make absolutely sure your meat, milk, and medicines stay safe and cool in any power outage. Yours free at MySolarBackup.com.
USA News Update. Opening statements scheduled for Monday in Donald Trump's hush money trial in Manhattan. A jury of 12 and 6 alternates sworn in to serve. Trump telling reporters this is a giant witch hunt. More now from USA's John Schaefer.
6 alternate jurors have been selected for former President Trump's hush money trial. I'm John Schaefer.
And a very disturbing moment outside the courthouse. A man from Florida lit himself on fire. White smoke billowing from the scene. Police say he posted wild conspiracy theories online. He was rushed to a burn center in Manhattan for treatment, but we have learned this Saturday from the New York City Police Department that this man has passed away. President Biden with no public comment about Israel's retaliation strike on Iran. This comes after Iran firing more than 300 missiles and drones into Israel. And I'm Laura Winters, USA News.
Wellness and self-care doesn't have to be complicated. So keep it simple and take good care of yourself with Sunny Bay heating pads. Our heating pads soothe pains in the neck, back, and shoulders while relaxing muscles and increasing blood circulation. Sunny Bay heating pads have always been made in the USA and hand-filled to perfection with the highest quality materials. Sunny Bay heating pads are the perfect wellness gift for loved ones or yourself. See all of our high-quality products at sunny-bay.com, including heated body pads, neck pillows, heated neck and body wraps, and our stress-reducing lavender line. They're all affordable, durable, and in stock now and ready for immediate shipping direct from sunny-bay.com. Read our trusted, authentic, and real reviews at sunny-bay.com or just search for Sunny Bay Heating Pad. To your good health and wellness from Sunny Bay.
Stop aging now. Restore those joints. Boost your strength. Because it's official. NutraMedical has released the most exciting, powerful anti-aging supplement on the market. Dr. Bill Deagle's Red Deer Velvet DR has been approved by the U.S. Patent Office. Imagine stem cell rejuvenation all in one capsule without huge expense. Dr. Bill MD discovered that as an unborn baby grows in the mother's womb, he or she does not deteriorate or physically age. Red Deer Velvet DR, like the uterus, provides 300 biomolecules and 6 hormones protected in one special DR capsule that delivers lipid packages directly into your circulation. This patented technology bypasses the stomach and is released into the small bowel unaltered by digestive enzymes and stomach acid. Remember, Red Deer Velvet DR. Improve endurance, stimulate your immune system, increase learning ability, and even improve sexual libido with Red Deer Velvet DR. Click NutriMedical.com. That's NutriMedical.com. Or call toll-free 888-212-8871 and get on the road to a newer, rejuvenated, happier you.
This is Jerome Clark, author of the UFO Encyclopedia and other books. You're listening to the Paracast.
Okay, this device sounds interesting here. It sounds like we're revisiting this TV show, this TV mystery show, which they call Steampunk, which, of course, is Murdoch Mysteries from Canada, where they look at early inventions that later became things that we know and care about. So, obviously, this was a very involved mechanical thingy to make this work. How did it progress to something more, shall we say, electronic?
The first and simple answer to that question is Albert Einstein. Here's where I will ask a rhetorical question. Do you know what Einstein was awarded the Nobel Prize for in 1921?
Remind me, pray tell.
The photoelectric effect. Most people, when asked that question, will immediately gravitate toward relativity and E equals MC squared. But those papers actually came later in the year 1905, which is the year that Albert Einstein turned the world upside down with the new cosmology of relativity and quantum mechanics. And the first paper that he published in 1905 was an articulation and quantification of the photoelectric effect, which is the phenomenon by which particles of light strike certain metals and turn them into particles of electricity. When we start to talk about particles in that context, or quanta as they became known, that paper literally is the cornerstone of quantum mechanics and everything we think we know about how things work at the subatomic level. So that is the answer to your question. How did we get from mechanical contrivances to something that was purely electronic? And it begins with Einstein's photoelectric effect. And here's where I will do my little sidebar, where after the summer of Oppenheimer, when we're all focused on the latter parts of Einstein's equation, E equals MC squared, and its potentially devastating effects, we've lost track of his actual greatest gift which preceded that, which was the science that turns light into electricity and gives us all the ability to see each other around the world. That starts with Einstein in 1905. Philo Farnsworth was born in 1906. So that's an important demarcation because he essentially grows up in a world that had never not known relativity and quantum mechanics. So his paradigm, his perception of how the universe works is completely different from the Newtonian mechanics that went before that, that rendered these contraptions that I've tried to describe with the spinning wheels. So he steps into a whole new, fresh paradigm where quantum mechanics, relativity, the photoelectric effect are now the dominant cosmology. And his backstory is that he grew up on a relatively in very modest conditions on a farm. He gets to Idaho in 1918 when he's about 11 years old. He actually encounters electricity firsthand for the first time. No, at that point, he had read about it, and he knew that there was such a thing as electricity, but he'd never seen it or done anything with it prior to that. And even prior to that, he knew of the world of science and invention. And he had confided in his father at a relatively young age his hope that he had been born an inventor. He admired the Edisons and the Bells and the DeForests of the worlds, and he wanted to follow in their footsteps. But he also recognized that there was an element of fate and destiny to that, and the way he worded that to his father, saying, I hope I have been born an inventor. So he already has that mindset, and he has the paradigm of Einstein's cosmology, and he kind of begins to hear about this thing called radioscope or teleramophone. I can't think of any of the other things they were calling it at the time, but we're talking about television. And he actually has the cognizant moment where he thinks that television might be a good thing to invent to launch a career as an inventor. So he begins to focus on that possibility, and he can sense, again, we're talking about an entirely different cosmological paradigm by now, as we're getting into the period right after World War I, around 1920 in that vicinity, where he is thinking entirely differently. He has already arrived in an entirely different mindset, and he has a thorough grasp of everything that Einstein wrote in 1905, even at a very young age. He was clearly gifted. And he begins to wonder how the things that he's learning from Einstein's work could apply to this thing that he wants to do to send moving pictures through the air. So over the course of his self-taught studies, he was very much an autodidact. He taught himself with the materials that he could find. He learns about some fundamental things. He learns about electrons. He learns that electrons are charged and can be deflected with magnets. And he learns about cathode ray tubes, which had already been demonstrated to have the ability to turn an electron flow into a glowing light on the end of a cathode ray tube. And so he has these elements simmering in his mind in the summer of 1921. And the legend is that he's actually plowing a field one afternoon. We don't know if it was potatoes, as everybody thinks, because it was Idaho, or the family thought it was sugar beets. But regardless, he's plowing a field, sitting at the what they call the business end, at the back of a horse on something called a disc harrow, turning up this field. And at the end of the afternoon's work, the story is that he turned around to see the work that he had done and the furrows that he had plowed in the field, and in a moment he is visited by the inspiration where he suddenly sees how, as there are rows of dirt in the field in front of him, he can use magnets to bounce electrons back and forth in a cathode ray tube and use a pure expression of Einstein's photoelectric effect in a vacuum tube to turn light into electricity. That's the moment that electronic video arrived on the planet, sometime in the summer of 1921.
Let's take that to step number two here. Okay, having been plowing the field, coming up with this inspiration, what happens next?
Nothing. He sits on it for Well, in truth of fact, he sat on the idea for about 5 years. Now, that is not to say that he didn't do anything. Once he had this conception, and in inventor speak, a thing is invented the moment it is conceived. And when it shows up on a workbench, that's called reduction to practice. But for inventors, that moment that he had in the field in Idaho, that was the moment of invention or the moment of conception. So once he has the conception, he then begins to even more rigorously study the field to determine to the best of his ability if this idea that has struck him is viable. And he learns more and more about electrons and magnets and cathode ray tubes and the photoelectric effect. And the actual first disclosure where he tells somebody about the idea is sometime in the late winter or early spring of 1922. He is a student at Rigby High School in Rigby, Idaho. He, over the course of the past couple of years, had manipulated, cajoled his way into the senior chemistry class, and he was being tutored by the teacher of that class, a man, Justin Tolman. And Tolman comes into he's tutored after class, and Tolman leaves the classroom and comes back after a while, and he sees something that he doesn't recognize at all drawn on the chalkboard in the science classroom at Rigby, Idaho, and standing before it is his prodigal student, Philo T. Farnsworth. And Justin Tolman asks his student, what is this? What has this got to do with chemistry? And Philo says, this is my idea for electronic television. And Justin Tolman says, television? What's that?
We will answer the questions about the origins of the CRT, television, and more with Paul, Gene, and Tim here in
The Paracast.
You are listening to GCN. Visit GCNLive.com today.
If you love mysteries, you'll love these two books by Tim R. Swartz and Sean Castile. In Mimics, The Others Among Us, you'll learn about the strange beings that can look like us, but are not. In Alien Artifacts, Incredible Evidence of Exotic Material from UFO Encounters, you'll see the hard evidence of UFOs that has been ignored or even hidden. These books will definitely blow your mind, and both are now available on Amazon.com.
First came Attack of the Rockoids, and it was a critically acclaimed success. And now there's The Coming of the Protectors. A former military intelligence man is contacted by a space woman in a dream. A dream that turns out to be a nightmare, because evil forces on her distant planet are planning to conquer the Earth. This is gripping science fiction of the classic kind. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors. Find out more at Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids, Rockoids.com.
What if you could cut your heating bills this winter with your existing wood-burning fireplace and not spend thousands doing it? You can with Great Wall of Fire Fireplace Grates. Our U.S.-patented, made-in-America Wall of Fire Grates increase fireplace efficiency, eliminate fireplace smoke problems, and come with a 30-day money-back guarantee. See our grates in action and get free shipping from walloffire.com or call 800-274-7364. Fireplace heat without fireplace smoke. Walloffire.com.
Complement your health with hemp-derived cannabinoid oil. We've always believed that the closer to Earth, the better it is for our bodies. Our hemp-derived cannabinoid oil is phytocannabinoid-rich, full-spectrum, and organically grown. Finally, hemp made easy, clean, and effective. GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203. That's right, we cut through the red tape. It's now available at GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203.
It's happening daily. We're being conned by the institutions we used to trust.
The mainstream media is distracting us with meaningless headlines instead of focusing on the harsh realities facing American families. Time is short before something big happens, and that's why so many folks are preparing. They're becoming self-reliant by investing in emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and secure four-week emergency food kits for each member of your family. Each kit contains tasty breakfasts, lunches, and dinners, averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Save $50 on each four-week food kit you purchase. Plus, get free shipping on Ready Hour four-week emergency food kits. You're not ready if it's not Ready Hour Foods. At My Patriot Supply, you can also get solar power generators, water filtration units, heirloom seeds, and survival gear. Order by 3 p.m. and your unmarked boxes ship the same day. Shop MyPatriotSupply.com today. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a free copy of my lecture that tells you exactly how to do it. In fact, after you've lived a long and healthy life, there should be only two documents in your medical chart, a birth certificate and a death certificate. I'm Dr. Wallach with a warning. If you have a 4-inch medical chart, if you take prescription drugs for high cholesterol, high blood pressure, arthritis, joint pains, and other health issues, the medical profession is failing you. They're using you for an ATM machine. My free lecture is going to reveal what pharmaceutical companies don't want you to know. There's been groundbreaking research and discoveries on how to effectively treat or eliminate over 900 different diseases naturally. It's all in my free lecture called Deadly Recipe. So call toll-free 1-855-79-YOUNG. Again, that's toll-free 1-855-79-YOUNG. 1-855-79-YOUNG.
Hi, this is Don Ecker, and you are tuned into the Paracast. Let me tell you what, you're going to hear stuff here that you probably won't hear anywhere else. Hear that, George Snorri?
Return with us now to 1922, where Philo Farnsworth introduces television. Is that the word he used?
Yeah, that was the word, that was the popular term by then. So that term had been popularized, and you see it even in magazines that were being published at the time. There was one in particular called Science and Invention, which I believe was a precursor to what became Popular Science, published by a man named Hugo Gernsback. If you've ever heard of the Hugo Science Fiction Awards, they were named for Hugo Gernsback. That was one of the magazines that Farnsworth was reading as a kid.
About Gernsback, Hugo Gernsback.
Sure.
Of course,
yeah.
The award in sci-fi, Science Fiction Award, the Hugo. Also, the connection to the UFO field is very rough here. One of the magazines he founded was Amazing Stories. One of the editors of Amazing Stories was Ray Palmer. Ray Palmer introduced, number one, the Shaver mystery about alleged beings underneath the earth with heroes and tiros. And then he was the co-founder of Fate magazine, which was one of the first nationally published magazines to cover not just the paranormal, ghosts and such, but flying saucers.
Really?
Yeah. You see how things kind of move around in circles there?
It's all of a piece and seems to be being slowly revealed. Well, I'm not entirely certain, but I think if Gernsback didn't coin the term television, he was among one of the first to use it publicly. So by that time in 22, when Farnsworth draws his sketch for his high school science teacher, that's the term that we're using to describe moving pictures that fly through the air. Now it's known as television. And they spent the late hours of that afternoon in February or March of 1922 talking about these ideas, and it was well over Tolman's head, but he knew enough of science and chemistry to think that it might have some merit. And before they were done, Philo drew this sketch of what became the image dissector tube. This is the vacuum tube embodiment of Einstein's photoelectric effect. He drew a sketch for him on a sketch pad, on a notepad, and tore it off and handed it to Justin Tolman, Tolman hung on to it, and it shows up again later in the story, but I don't want to jump to that. But I just for now know that in 1922, that was one of the few times he actually discussed that idea with anybody. The rest of the time, he just kept it simmering in the gray matter between his ears. Now, having said that, I want to add that this is a measure of how advanced this thinking was, that he sat on this idea from 1921 until he obtained funding to begin experimenting with it in 1926. So we're talking about a period of at least 5 years. And that entire time, every time he opens a scientific journal or a scientific pulp magazine, he thinks he's going to see that somebody else has come up with that same idea. And nobody did. He sat on that idea. That idea was unique to him for 5 years. That's how advanced this kid was.
5 years. What happened next?
In 1926, he's gone through sporadic schooling. His father died. He became responsible for the family. He's actually spent some time in the Navy. So one important demarcation from that point is he got teased about his name while he was in the Navy. They called him, instead of Philo, they called him Fido, and they made fun of the name. So he decides to drop the O and become simply Phil. So we're now going to refer, from 1926 on in this story, we're going to refer to him as Phil Farnsworth, and occasionally we'll fall back on Philo. But I need that distinction because when I met the family in 1975, I met his oldest son, Philo T. Farnsworth III, and I've got great stories about him. But the family always referred to the son, Philo III, as Philo, and the father, who invented television, as Phil. So I'll use Phil from now on. In 1926, he's gone through sporadic education. He gets a job in Salt Lake City at a community chest campaign and talks himself into the job of office manager for the whole operation and rather endears himself to the man who set up this community chest campaign, a financier from Northern California named George Everson. And George was well-placed in the financial circles, mostly around San Francisco, and worked with Phil on this community chest campaign. And then after staying late one night to put out a mailing, George just asked Phil, who was of college age at this point but not in college, he asked Phil, well, what are your plans? What are you planning to do when we're done here? And then Phil confided that he had this idea for something called television, and he was certain that it would work, but it had been hard for him to get funding for it. And George was not particularly piqued with the idea immediately, but there was another colleague, a man named Les Gorel, who had an engineering degree from, I believe, Stanford. And Les heard this idea, and it struck a chord for him. It resonated with him. So after they all split up, Les encouraged George to listen more closely to Phil's ideas. And so they all got together again, and Phil went into much more detail. By this point, he's worked the whole thing up. He knows what he has to do, and he knows that he can do it. And they discussed the idea at greater length. And George says, well, I've got about $5,000 of mad money stashed away that I've been saving for some kind of flyer. And this is about as much of a flyer as I can think of. And he offers that $5,000 to Phil so that he can start working on this idea. Things at that point begin moving pretty quickly. Phil marries. He and his bride, Pam, go to Los Angeles. They start building circuits in an apartment in Los Angeles. And then George goes up to San Francisco to try to get more money. He eventually assembles a group of people who are associated with the Crocker Bank. In particular, there were three individuals primarily. The wizened old gold rush banker, George Daddy Fagan, an engineer and capitalist industrialist named Roy Bishop and another bank executive named Jess McCarter. And they, in the summer of 26, agreed to stake Philo Farnsworth to $25,000, a laboratory in a loft in San Francisco, and a year to make it work. So he goes to, he moves to San Francisco, and in, I'm going to say January of 1927, they filed. They got a patent attorney. That's where part of the $25,000 went. They filed patents and or applied for patents so that the work that they were doing would now be protected, because now a statement has been made to the patent office that this idea exists as of this date. And that date was January 30th of 1927. And then he goes to work in earnest, and in September of 1927, he has gone through several iterations of what he calls the image dissector tube, is the camera tube. And the camera tube, for what it's worth, is the missing link to the whole thing. It's when you have a good camera tube that you can begin to produce a good television signal. And the cathode ray tube receiver, he called the oscillate. That's like an, he's made that in an Erlenmeyer flask of all things. But the camera tube had to be fabricated from scratch. And on the night of September 7th, 1927, he is ready to test the apparatus for the first time, or maybe it's the second or third time, but this time he's certain it's going to work. And all they had was a straight line painted on a glass slide. And they shine a bright light through this glass slide at the surface of this image dissector tube that he's fabricated from scratch. And when they can see that the straight line rotates from horizontal to vertical, when they can see that on the oscillate receiving tube in the other room, they know that intelligence is being transmitted from the bottle, from the bottom of one bottle to the bottom of another. And the idea that he had on that hayfield in 1921 was valid. It has been reduced to practice. And in that moment, September 7th, 1927, video as we know it has arrived on the planet for the first time.
We have Paul Shatskin, writes about people nobody heard about. And Mr. Farnsworth, we should have heard about him. With Gene and Phil and Tim, you're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
Hey, listeners, I want you to have the entire Paracast experience. So I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
I need some extra money. Do I qualify for the Earned Income Tax Credit?
Use the EITC Assistant tool. With just a little information, this tool helps you calculate eligibility with ease and accuracy, get an estimate of how much credit you qualify for, and get a printout of your results before you prepare your return or visit your tax preparer. To use the EITC Assistant tool and see if you're eligible to claim a credit, visit irs.gov/EITC.
Honorary Forest Ranger Betty White here, lending a hand to my dear friend Smokey Bear, because for 75 years, he's only said,
only you can prevent wildfires.
But there's a lot more to say. Like, if you park your car on tall, dry grass, the hot exhaust pipe can start a wildfire. So be careful out there. Go to smokybear.com to learn more about wildfire prevention. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.